so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
All right, we're back after an extended absence. Are you feeling okay, Matt Kolsky?
I'm not going to lie to you. I've got a large cup of tea next to me, and I will be muting myself in order to blow my nose at least 7 times during the recording of this podcast. But generally speaking, I am feeling significantly better. I got hit with what I think is, I guess this is the flu that I had, because I always, from when I was a kid, I always thought flu meant vomit. But I've been informed that no, flu can just be like really severe cold cough symptom type stuff. That's what they call the flu now.
And yeah, you know, the cold is a mild form of the flu.
Right. So, I've learned this, and this was full on flu because it was about 5 days of misery for me.
Well, I am sitting here with a large glass of scotch in my hand. So if this podcast goes off the rails, you know, in the next 20 to 30 minutes.
down it goes, down into my belly.
All right, so it's been a couple weeks. We've got a lot to cover. Do you want to start in the sports world?
Yeah, let's.
All right. I mean, we are taping this on a Tuesday. You'll probably hear it on a Wednesday. And tonight, the Golden State Warriors going for history. I mean, they've got a share of history as it is.
Right, tonight being Wednesday. That was confusing to me, the way you laid that out. Tonight, which is actually Tuesday when we're recording, is not the night. Tomorrow, yes. Wednesday, when you're listening. So really, I guess tonight. I see what you did there.
It's only tonight for me and you. For everyone else who's hearing this, it'll be, you know. Or sorry, it's only tomorrow night for me and you.
Right.
For everyone else, it'll be tonight.
Right.
Or yesterday, or whatever.
No, it'll be tonight, because this will come out on a Wednesday. You have my personal guarantee.
Yes, yes, but you know, someone might be listening to it on Thursday or Friday.
Oh, that's a great point.
Yeah.
The Warriors may already have broken the NBA's wins record.
Do you, I mean, it is weird. It does sort of feel like they have, it's like break it or bust, right? Like if they do finish at 72-10, it'll feel like a little bit of a letdown, right? Even though they will have tied the greatest achievement in NBA history, perhaps. Greatest regular season achievement, I should say.
Well, I think there's a couple reasons for that. One is it's just been, you know, mathematically not a foregone conclusion, but it has looked good for a couple of weeks. Yeah. That plays into that. And here's the other thing. I've pulled up some background research. If you can't, for your 73rd win of the season, beat a Memphis team that tonight against the LA Clippers is playing a squad that, outside of Zach Randolph, includes Chris Anderson, Matt Barnes, Jordan Farmar, Vince Carter as the starting five, that's kind of depressing and unfortunate, right?
Where's Mike Conley? Is Conley hurt?
He's out. Gasol out, Conley out. They're the walking wounded. So part of it is that. And you know, look, once you're here, you might as well do it. Because I'll tell you what you're not going to do is get here again next year.
Yeah. No, that's – well, you know, I mean, the previous record holders, they were – made a run at it the following season, didn't they? They were in the high 60s, I believe.
They got to 69, the Bulls did. But here's the difference is that was their second title run. The Warriors will be coming off of back-to-back deep. I mean, even if they don't win the title, back-to-back deep playoff runs. It'd be shocking if they don't at least make the conference finals. And the idea of doing that in the third season, I just think from the beginning it would go very differently. Steve Kerr will rest guys a lot more, and I just don't think they'll have a shot at 70-plus. Doesn't mean they won't win high 60s, but I don't think they'll really go for it the way
they
have this year.
it is hard to imagine that the health would hold up too.
Yeah, that's a factor as well. And for all we know, there could be actual significant roster changes for the Warriors this off season. You know,
yeah,
depending
Kevin
on what
Durant
and Kevin Durant and all that. Yeah, that could. To be honest, if they do get Kevin Durant, then maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they will challenge this again.
I will say you do see, you know, the various power indexes and 538s of the world, you know, projecting 91-93% chance of a victory. And I think it's less than that. You know what I mean? Not just, you know, and this is a completely non-statistical argument, but you're going to have a Memphis team is tough, played the Warriors tough in the playoffs last year, and is just really not going to want to be the team that gives up this record.
Well, you know, and one guy, at least, Zach Randolph, if he's out there, which he is playing tonight or last night or several nights ago, depending on when you listen to this, that is not a dude that likes to be on the receiving end of other people's record breaking.
Right.
Randolph will do everything in his power, but I just don't think there's that much he can do.
You can say what you want about the starting lineup that includes Zach Randolph, the Birdman, and Matt Barnes. But you can also say that
those
a starting
are the best
lineup
three
with
guys
those
in
three,
that lineup, by the way.
With those three includes three crazy mofos.
It does. So. That's a fair point. You get into anything can happen territory pretty quickly with that group.
Yes.
But look, I mean, odds are, you know, if it's not 90, what is it, 80? I mean,
I feel like 75, something
okay.
like that, you know what I mean?
That's a
but
damn that, good I, chance of breaking
it's a
the
good
NBA's.
Chance. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think Memphis has a chance in this game, and I, you know what I mean? I just a, even if it's a puncher's chance, I think they got a puncher's chance. I don't think it's an 8-9% chance.
Okay, fine. I'll give you that. I would say maybe it's 80-20, but that's pretty overwhelming in favor of the Warriors.
Yeah, and it'll be – look, so obviously the question that has been bouncing around in some form all year, but certainly at a fever pitch now, is who would win, you know, a series between the 95-96 Bulls and this current Warriors team?
Just quickly before we dive into this, I do think it's important to point out, and I'm not original here, the actual answer to this question, to this unanswerable question, is very easy, and it is that it depends completely upon what rules you played under.
Oh, thank God. I thought you were going to just say it's Steve Kerr's team is going to win, and then I was going to get really angry.
No, that would have been a good moment for that bad joke, though. No, it's just if the Bull – I mean, at least we can say this. If the Bulls were allowed to put hands on people the way you were allowed to in the 95-96 NBA season, I am very confident they would beat the Warriors, and it would not be especially close.
I'm less confident in that than you are.
Okay.
I think the hand-checking thing is somewhat overblown.
Well,
it's not just
hand-checking. It's hard fouls.
It's just being on people. The Warriors are also an exceptional free throw shooting team.
No, actually they're not. Steph Curry is an exceptional free throw shooter, and Klay Thompson's very good. But other than that, they got some real struggles because Bogut and Iguodala can't shoot at all. Draymond Green is not where you'd like him to be. I believe he's under 70%. So as a team, they're actually not that great.
Right. But I also think that that also underrates the Warriors' newfound ability in that scenario to lay hard and dirty fouls, which we something we know Andrew Bogut is pretty good at. And
true.
I suspect Draymond Green and Andre Iguodala would be pretty good at as well.
They would have no problem, but just
and look,
say what you want about Draymond Green and Andrew Bogut, who are tough, hard-nosed defenders that are more than capable of delivering a hard foul. We're talking about Pippen, Jordan, and Rodman.
Yeah, I understand that. But also, look, I mean, like the, you know, I would say the guy that gives, you know, the Steph the most mid-90s style opposition is Chris Paul, right? in terms of the way he's going to grab and clutch and force the referee to call,
yeah,
you
but
know,
now,
call a tight game against
but
you.
Now imagine if Chris Paul was 6'6 to 6'8 as Ron Harper, Michael Jordan, and Scottie Pippen all are, and also just a better defender than Chris Paul by a large margin. So
yeah, but what I'm saying, you know, Curry performs pretty well against
he does.
That. And you don't want to put a 6'8 dude on Chris on Steph Curry. Have we seen that enough?
I would be pretty comfortable with Scottie Pippen on Steph Curry, yes. And just to be clear, by no means am I saying, well, you completely neutralize Steph Curry or anything ridiculous like that. Just that given those parameters, I think the Bulls overall would prevail pretty convincingly.
Here's the other thing is that do you realize that the Warriors of the two teams are the taller and heavier team?
Well,
that's something I think people don't quite understand. I think they look at the Warriors, you know, the Warriors have the reputation of being a finesse perimeter team, and obviously, but they have some size and some heft and some strength.
Yes. Again, two of the greatest teams of all time. I think one is the greatest team of all time. And taller and heavier, that's a little surprising. I don't entirely know what that means, but certainly in some critical positions.
Well, but
that's
a definable, measurable thing. You know what I mean? If you
are you taking
the heights of the players and the weights of the players.
I guess, what's the, you have those numbers in front of you?
Hold on. I'm looking at the roster right now, Basketball Reference, but of course they're not arranged by, you know, height and weight.
I think you could probably sort by height. Yeah.
But that is a fact that I have read. Oh, wait, here we go. So there's heights and weights. Hold on.
That seems hard for me to believe. The Bulls had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 players 6'10 and above.
The Warriors have Bogut at 7 foot, Azeli at 6'11, Spates at 6'10, and Varejao at 6'10, plus two more guys at 6'9.
I just that looking at this, I find what you're saying very hard to believe in it. And if it is true, it's by a slight margin, and that's probably because guys in general were skinnier and lighter back then.
Yeah, well, but it's supposed to be more physical, you know.
Well, it was.
I mean, I don't know.
But Scottie Pippen was 6'8", 210 because guys didn't put on mass the same way they do now.
Yeah, well, but that counts.
Well, I know it counts, but Scottie was still capable of bumping and shoving with anybody. Mm. Also, Dennis Rodman listed at 6'7", but played 6'12".
All right, let's get back into the larger point of this, which is that, look, we're, you know, this is the ultimate farm for hot takes,
yes.
I feel like, because there's total safety in it.
Right.
Right?
It will never happen.
You can't ever be proven wrong.
Correct.
Which is great. And so, you know, old guys who want to tell you how much better it is in back in their day are having a field day with this, which is why we've seen so many people not only proffer that the Bulls would win, but that the Bulls would sweep.
I don't think that's true at all. Even in the scenario I described, even where I said the Bulls win convincingly, I'm talking 6, maybe 5 games.
I would bet... Okay, maybe not my life, but your life. I would bet your life that the Warriors would get at least a game. And honestly, I think they'd have a decent chance to win the series. But a sweep is so beyond preposterous.
I agree.
That Bulls team didn't sweep the Sonics. They didn't sweep the Knicks. There is no way that they're sweeping this, we can all agree, historically at least top 10 team. It's just not going to happen. It's just like, say what you want about the rules and whatever. At the very least, the Warriors have been a historically great offensive team with two historically great shooters who are capable of setting fire to anything that they touch, regardless of who's defending them. I think we've seen enough body of evidence that that is the case. They, you know, if you're talking about just their ability to get one game, I mean, we're being ridiculous, and yet people keep putting this in print. You don't see anyone saying, oh, the Warriors will sweep. But you keep hearing this idea that the 95-96 Bulls team would sweep. And I think, honestly, and I feel comfortable in saying this because I am of the age, you know, that I watched this team kind of in my prime sporting years. And I think it's so much of a function of that, that, like, this was the legendary team that you've grown up with, and since then they've only grown in stature in your mind. And so you want to talk about them like people talk about the 85 Bears in the Saturday Night Live skit, where, you know, it's like, you know, a car full of Phil Jacksons, you know, like against the Russian army, who's going to win, you know?
Trick question. Phil Jackson is the Russian army. No,
yeah,
you're right.
It's just old sports writers coming out of the woodwork to say things were better in my day, which is, once again, the most boring argument. I don't know who this guy was in Chicago. It's the same guy who...
Bernie Lincecum, and I don't even want to talk about him. He's a schmuck, but... quickly, the only thing more tired and obnoxious than players from days of yore whining about how great they were and how much better things were back then is sports writers from days of yore who aren't relevant whining about how much better things were in the past. It's impossibly stupid to suggest that the Bulls... I mean, look, anything could happen. Could that team sweep any team ever? Probably. If they played their best every single night, there's a chance. But if we're doing any sort of reasonable handicapping, the idea that you would put this team, led by Steph Curry, with Klay Thompson on it, the way they play offense, the way they're coached, the way they defend, for that matter, and think they wouldn't steal a game.
They're nearly unbeatable at home.
Yeah, to think they wouldn't sneak in and steal at least one game is patently ridiculous. I completely agree with you. And I mean, look, the rules are one thing, which obviously I mentioned off the top, but there's a million different things that could equalize the playing field in a variety of ways.
All right, let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say it's like baseball.
Don't say that. I love basketball much more than baseball.
But let's say it's like a baseball-type situation where, okay, when in the games in Chicago, they're played under 95-96 rules, and the games in Golden State are played under modern rules.
Like a split DH situation.
Yeah, exactly. Who in your mind wins the series then?
Man, I don't know, but I would love to watch it. You know, I lean towards the Bulls, but I honestly can't tell if that is just nostalgia and the things that we've talked about, or if that's based in anything real. I mean, I'll say this. They were, you know, using the modern statistics that people use, the Bulls of that year were the best offensive team and the best defensive team. The Warriors are not that, although they're the best offensive team and one of the, what, top four, I think, defensive teams. So it's not far off, but that extra bump is convincing to me. And also,
I guess
we never saw Michael...
I think then you have to factor in that you could make a case that they're another one of the top 10 teams of all time, at least statistically, is playing in this season.
Yeah,
when you're talking about ranks and whatnot, I mean, and that's the number one defensive team. You know what I mean? So
that is the number one, but the Warriors are not number two either, I don't believe. So, you know, again, they're not part of that. Yes, is relative to what else is going on in the league, but also that just reflects that they truly were the greatest on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, look, they dominated that season. I'm curious. I mean, we sort of touched on it a little bit. Do you think it's interesting that Kerr kind of sidesteps this question? Do you think it's just because it's a lose-lose for him where, you know, he's got 12 guys who are going to be mad at him no matter what answer he gives?
No,
or
I don't think
– he gets something else.
I don't see him as being that – sort of careful or calculating. The Warriors are fifth in defensive rating this year, for the record. Here's another, again, this is just random statistical jargon to a degree, but the Warriors' expected win-loss for this year is 64-17, whereas the Bulls was 70-12. So the Bulls were better. The Bulls were better, if that makes sense, at that time. And yeah, that's relative, but that's something in their favor, at least to a degree. Also, and some of this is anecdotal, with regard to what I remember about that Bulls season, but, you know, I was 14, 15, so I was aware, and I watched it very, very carefully. I don't remember as many games that the Bulls had to grab by the skin of their teeth in that season. And I think that's reflected in the expected win-loss to a degree.
Yeah, maybe. I'd want to see some game logs. You know, here's the number that jumps out at me. And obviously, look, it's indicative of context of the game, I understand. But it's still just eye-popping. Steph Curry, with one game to go, sitting on 392, made three-pointers for the year.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's amazing. The 95-96 Bulls as a team made 544.
Yeah, I mean, that's not, but that's completely reflective of the time.
Well, as I said at the top, that is context dependent, but it still just sort of pops your eye. And then you start getting into, you know, percentages and whatnot. I mean, you know, Curry shooting 45% from three.
It's absurd.
As a team. Yeah, which is full 5% better than the Bulls did as a team. So,
well, yeah, that's not particularly surprising. In fact, I'm a little surprised the Bulls shot the three as well as they did that year, thanks largely to that's Jordan's best three-point shooting year, and also Tony Kukoc had a really good season.
Well, don't forget, Steve Kerr, percentage-wise,
all-time
leaders.
Yeah, but he didn't take enough to have that much of an effect on them. Well,
he shot three. He shot,
oh, God, shot 51%
for three that year with 237 attempts. So, like, that's,
you know,
not, yeah,
that might be Steve Kerr's best season.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was third on the team in three-point attempts. So,
Yeah.
Oh, Scottie Pippen shot 400 at 37%.
Yeah. But, you know, 37% was...
Back then, I guess, was pretty good.
Yeah, that was really pretty good. The outlier really is Jordan, because he shot almost 43% from three-point range that year. He's a career, like, 30-something. Career, his three-point shooting percentage is 32%. So, well,
yeah.
Part of that was he took a bunch of bad ones in Washington, but
yeah, Kerr had an all time year.
Kerr was great. Him, so. I mean, look, and that's the other thing is I think, you know, right now it's easy for us to remember the value of Mo Spates and Leandro Barbosa, and you know some of these guys, even Andre Iguodala, or Andrew Bogut, where 20 years from now, you know, we look back and we're like, Luke Longley? I mean, Ron Harper? Like,
but see, I don't know. I remember the value of Luke Longley and Ron Harper in particular.
Tony Kukoc? Like, I don't Kukoc think people realize how critical Kukoc was to that squad.
You know, like, they had some good players, for sure. Jack Haley waving the towels? I remember that.
Yeah. The best towel waver of these six Warrior titles was undoubtedly Cliff Levingston, though, who did it in the first three.
Yeah. I feel like the Warriors would be allowed to bring back Kent Bazemore and like not have him play, but just have him
just
on the bench
just
waving towels.
Yeah. I mean, isn't he supposed to be busy with your squad? Like, what's the deal with that? Are the Hawks just not going to really take this one off?
The Hawks are not my squad.
Oh, they're not?
No. No, I jumped on your bandwagon, like, I don't know, 5-6 years ago.
Oh, interesting.
But
that's not my bandwagon, because my squad still is the Bulls, by the way.
That is true. Look, the Hawks are going to be competitive. I believe that, you know, kind of everything's up for grabs for them on the final night of the season, where they could finish, I think, anywhere from third to fifth or sixth, depending on how things play out.
That's another interesting thing about
But they're
this.
Not going to beat Cleveland, you know? They're not going to beat Cleveland. Who's going to be Cleveland in the East?
I think Toronto could.
Right.
And I think Boston could if they get the right situation.
I think Boston could take a couple games, but I just don't see them winning seven.
And honestly, I don't know what the situation with the Heat is right now. But that's a team where if they somehow were all healthy at once, that it's an interesting look. I think the Cavs are vulnerable. That being said, I don't have the stats in front of me, but what LeBron's done over the last 8 or 10 games is elevate himself to basically peak LeBron, where he's shooting like 60%. He's scoring almost 30 points a game. He's got like 8 rebounds and 8 assists a game. So, you know.
How are his tweets? Are his Instagrams in top form?
Oh, do you not know what he did?
did he really do something? I haven't been paying attention. No,
oh my God, this is holy shit! I can't believe. No. This is definitely a thing.
Oh no!
Oh my God, LeBron made what I think is actually his worst social media screw up ever. Believe it or not.
Okay.
And what happened was, an Instagram, an 18-year-old Instagram model by the name of, I think it's Rachel Bush. Let me just Google this to make sure I got the right name. Who is simply ridiculous. Yeah, Rachel Bush, who's an 18-year-old Instagram model who's absurd, as you would imagine, for an Instagram model, was at the game with her boyfriend, whose name is Jordan Poyer. He plays for the Cleveland Browns. And,
you can't even get this out. I'm like, dude, just tell me, what happened?
So, she's at the game. She posts an Instagram with a photo of, you know, basketball players on the court. That literally says, with my bae. So she's there, courtside, with her Cleveland Browns boyfriend. And later that night, she posts on Instagram, which is a picture of her own DMs with a message from King James that says, hey, what's up?
But that's all it says is, hey, what's up?
Yeah, but with an exclamation point. So basically,
I mean, look, LeBron's not scandalous.
It's a little bit. I mean, LeBron slid into the DMs of an 18-year-old model at the game with her boyfriend. And here's the best part: when you see the picture of his DM, the little logo that pops up next to his message, because it's his icon, is a photo of his children. So it's like two kids. Hey, what's up? Exclamation point.
Yeah, like I said, you know, it's not a great look. Not, sure, it's not a great look.
Well, he hasn't made a lot of big social media screw-ups. I mean, he's unfollowed people, but that's more our freaking out over it. In terms of actual things he's actually done that have been shady, this is near the top.
Yeah, all right, fine.
Not a good look, bro. Not a good look.
I kind of wish he'd made a move on Kevin Love's girl. That would have been funnier.
I saw someone point out on Twitter, Kevin Love now the only like Cavs, significant Cavs piece to not be made a fool of on Instagram so far this season.
can we agree that Kevin Love is the star of the Hoopers? is he the MVP? I mean, dropping dimes, y'all.
No, I actually find Kevin Love's part of that to be the creepiest, and I also feel like he is the dude whose decision to engage is the least defensible. Because, like, I get it. Garnett, you're old, so you're playing with that. That's funny. Lillard is a baby, which is kind of funny. And you know, Chris Paul's just Chris Paul, strangely enough. And DeAndre Jordan goes way over the top with the wig. But Kevin Love is just, like, being sunned by these guys. He's a little kid.
But I mean, the Hawks and the Hornets?
I know. That's so – like, if I'm Kevin Love, no way am I giving the rubber stamp to that plan.
He's
no
doing
way.
By far the best action job of all five of them.
Ugh, God. I would never do that if I was him. It's as if you didn't already look like enough of a fool.
Bravo, Kevin Love. Dropping dimes. You keep dropping dimes.
We're on opposite sides of that one, friend.
Where'd you get all them dimes, Kevin?
Well, now that we've gotten... by the way, quickly, on the Warriors record, just to close that up, anyone who's a Bulls fan that is in the, I don't want to see him break the record, this is the Bulls record camp, should go and, like, summer with Goose Gossage and all the other old-timers that want to whine about yesterday, because it's so stupid to not want to see more greatness.
Well, and at this point, it's not literally crying over spilled milk, because, like,
well, that
they have
also
to share,
like,
it at the very least. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's not yours anymore.
But let's say the Warriors win. Let's assume they do win. That doesn't diminish the Bulls at all.
Nope.
It doesn't change what happened. It doesn't make them any less champions or any less one of or the greatest team of all time. It just makes more greatness for us to see. That's what we're supposed to want, is to watch greatness in sports. And to fight against it is so dumb to me.
Yeah, we should have just all quit after 96. That's not getting better than this.
Well, that's the end of basketball.
You guys broke basketball. Thanks a lot. All right, let's switch gears and move into television. Is that where we're headed next?
Well, did we want to say goodbye to Kobe Bryant first?
Oh, yes. Let's do that as quickly as we possibly can, because Lord knows that thing has gone on long enough.
Yeah, 3 years is how long it's gone on, because this Kobe Bryant that everyone's talking about saying goodbye to said goodbye to us 3 years ago.
Right.
So
it is an interesting position. I'm assuming you've been to a few of these road games on the Kobe farewell tour.
Only one.
Yeah, I was at one as well, and it's such a weird thing because he's
like
so
it.
Bad, and it's hard to watch.
And
but everyone is clearly there to see him,
and he's clearly not there to compete.
And they're all chanting his name.
But think about that. Kobe Bryant is not competing. What is that? That's not the guy that people love. That's not the guy that people hated. That's not the guy. He's smiley and hugging people and sharing positive feelings. Like, this is not Kobe Bryant.
He's in a tough spot, because let's say that he was maniacal, killer, I'm Kobe Bryant, but, you know, I'm just not good anymore, but I'm still the same personality Kobe Bryant. That's a destructive force on that team.
But he's been a destructive force on that team by playing the way he's playing.
Isn't the solution to that to smile and chill and take the hugs and,
yes,
you know, roll out there, you know, when the coach asks you to? And
yeah, I'm not.
Chill out when you don't.
I'm not so much criticizing Kobe when I make that point as criticizing the breathless excitement over the farewell. You know, I don't understand the excitement to on sports radio today. I actually heard serious arguments about which would you rather see or be at, Kobe's last game or the Warriors breaking the record, and that's so crazy to me. Like, there's nothing.
Yeah, well, that's absurd.
There's nothing in Kobe's last game for me at all.
That's
not
absurd.
Kobe Bryant.
It's celebrity, isn't it? It's just, I want to be in the room with this person who is a star.
Exactly. And so, if you are a longtime Lakers fan who wants to be in the building to feel like you said goodbye, I guess that's the one emotion I can get. But the idea that an impartial observer would have any interest in watching Kobe Bryant when he'll probably shoot 5-for-20 in his last game ever, and you wave goodbye to someone who doesn't even resemble the guy who's one of the top 10 players of all time, I don't get it. That being said, he is one of the top 10 players of all time, and as ridiculous as that argument about the Warriors last 73 or Kobe's last game, is this comparison game we're playing today between Derek Jeter and Kobe Bryant? Are you kidding me?
Okay.
Kobe Bryant is fighting for a spot on Mount Rushmore. Derek Jeter might be one of the top 5 shortstops of all time.
Might be. Yes.
Might
and
be.
I think that question, I think you might have Kobe Bryant a little bit high. I think he's probably a top 12, top 15 player maybe.
Well, okay, but Jeter's not even in the conversation for that.
No. And Jeter's probably, I don't know, you could make a case for Jeter as a top 50 player maybe of all time. Maybe not, I don't know. But
that would be where you would start if you really liked Derek Jeter.
Is a celebrity, that's also a celebrity question, because Jeter is probably a top 10 baseball icon of all time. You know what I mean?
Well, that's
And
fine.
That's kind of, right, that's I think where that comparison goes around. You know what I mean? It's not even so much about being in the presence of greatness as it is being in the presence of star power.
Yeah, okay.
And charisma.
Well,
you know?
And that's fine, but you know, again, just not comparable as players. So I feel like Kobe deserves the respect of us really saying, yes, this guy is one of the greatest of all time in a very legitimate way, whether it's top 10 or top 15, versus, yes, we have to see the like fading red dwarf of this sad last season.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and it's certainly interesting to compare and contrast, because I think, you know, the comparison for Kobe is, isn't it Tim Duncan? You know what yes. I mean? Like, if you're going to compare guys, not necessarily play different positions, but relatively
no, but
the same
the guys.
Length of career spread across the same era, I mean, same number of titles. And just the way that one of them is going to go out versus the other one.
Yeah. Well, but that's
I think
to,
it's really interesting to me.
It is, and it speaks to the way both of them behave their entire careers, you know, and it's a credit to Tim Duncan, and I think it's one of the main reasons, if not the main reason, why I, given the choice, would take Tim Duncan's career over Kobe Bryant's career, and if I was building a team around those guys, you know, I would rather start my franchise with a young Tim Duncan than a young Kobe Bryant.
Well, I think it's almost unquestionable, and I think the marker there is there were literally no bad teams when Tim Duncan played, right? What are they, 19 straight years of 50 wins? Is that right?
Something like that. First? I mean, it's really ridiculous. And
there
Kobe,
have been some bad Lakers, not just these last couple. There have been some bad Laker teams during the Kobe tenure.
No question. You know? I mean, the Smush Parker era, of course, is not so distant in our minds. But part of that, of course, is general management and coaching as well. But I do think being that coachable superstar and also being sort of a low-key guy are advantages for Tim Duncan. But those are the two dudes. I mean, I don't think there's much question about that. I've always been a Kevin Garnett fan. I know you're not. But I'd be kidding myself if I tried to put him quite in that Kobe and Duncan category in terms of the guys who really defined this most recent generation that's now ending of superstars.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. And it's, you know, one got a lot more ink, one's going to go out with a lot more ink, and, you know, one's going to go out winning, what, 66 and maybe a title. So, You know, nothing Tim Duncan's necessarily done.
the way
if he
he's
came
going,
back for one more year and did this again, it wouldn't shock you.
Nope, so. Wouldn't surprise anybody, I don't think.
Should we move on to TV?
Yes, please.
All right. OJ wrapped up, and just completing the arc of a phenomenal run. I mean, just almost no perfect, right? Like, you know.
That's what I was going to say. I can't think of a single complaint. I mean, I just thought it was home run from start to finish, from a acting standpoint, from writing, from the way they chose to tell the story. I mean, I don't think we really talked about it, the way they had that sort of jury episode. Pitch perfect is the way to describe it. It was unbelievably well done, ridiculously well acted, and a joy to watch.
Yeah, and I don't know that we are capable of answering this question, but I'm sort of fascinated by how. Given that this came from Ryan Murphy, and we talked about this, I think, at the beginning of really when the season was coming out.
A polarizing figure, to say the least.
Certainly, and who certainly, I would think you could say, whether you love him or hate him, you would argue that his strengths or weaknesses, you know, both lie in excess, right? Either that's why you love him or why you don't.
Well, yeah, he's somewhat particular because of that. You know, he's not even an acquired taste, but a particular taste that only a certain kind of person likes. I think part of it is that this story lends itself so well to over the
talent.
Top,
yeah,
because everything that happened is so completely insane and ridiculous. But also,
but it's just so crazy to me that he got this like just right.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, like just right. It was perfect. You know,
and I think that's a credit as well to the acting, which did such a good job of bringing alive characters that I think most of the people who watch this show still remember reasonably well.
Yeah. Well, I'll be curious to see because you know next season's going to tackle Hurricane Katrina, which is an event a lot of us will. It's going to be a crime story, so I don't think we know specifically the frame of this story yet. I really hope Kanye West is at least tangentially involved, though.
So here's what the Hollywood Reporter wrote about the second season. It will center on Hurricane Katrina and its devastating aftermath. The working plan, according to Murphy, is to follow a group of 6 to 8 people in an attempt to examine all sides of the tragedy, from the Superdome to the hospital to those who were put on buses and dropped off with babies who were forced to wear trash bags for multiple days. Here's a quote from Ryan Murphy. I want this show to be a socially conscious, socially aware examination of different types of crime around the world, and in my opinion, Katrina was a f***ing crime. A crime against a lot of people who didn't have a strong voice, and we're going to treat it as a crime. That's what this show is all about. So a couple of things about that. Number one, obviously, first off, I agree. It's a crime on a lot of levels. But also, I think based on that description of what will happen, it won't necessarily be in the same way characters we know. It will be situations we're familiar with and stuff we remember, but it won't be Johnny Cochran and O.J. Simpson and
maybe, for the sound of that, if I'm Mike Brown, I'm not going to watch this show. That's what I'm going to say right there.
Sure.
I feel pretty solid that he'll be in it and it won't look good for him.
Yeah, there will be, but when it says 6 to 8 people in an attempt to examine all sides of the tragedy, I'm thinking people... I pictured normal people, as opposed to famous people.
Yeah, I think well, there aren't really, there aren't a ton of famous victims.
Exactly. I'm picturing victims, I guess, is what to put a finer point on it. So,
it would be very Murphy to have Sean Penn rowing through a scene in a lifeboat.
Yeah, that's very true. But I think that will be interesting because the Katrina, in addition to being a crime, is a tragedy on a grand scale. And as tragic as the death of two essentially innocent people was, it's much easier to look at the O.J. Simpson case as a tabloid, a maniacal tabloid scene that was, an interesting inflection point in celebrity in this country and in television and all this stuff that has so little to do with the tragedy of the crime itself. Whether or not the Murphy treatment, as it were, plays as well with something that is more basically tragic and more fundamentally upsetting, I don't know. I think that'll be very interesting to see.
It'll be interesting. Although, was it a serious, maybe, a transgression? No. But the O.J. thing at the time... really touched on a lot of serious societal stuff. I mean, I think the show did a good job of pointing that out, and was felt really deeply. You know what I mean? Within the country at the time. So.
But I'm not sure. But it wasn't felt. It's not. It wasn't really, sad as this is to say, it wasn't really felt deeply as the tragic death of Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman.
No,
it was race relations, and again, yes, lots of implications, lots of serious subjects came up, and they did in the show, but. The whole thing was still more spectacle in the entertainment category as opposed to crushing life tragedy for thousands upon thousands of people.
Yeah. Well, look, the good news is that, I think Murphy's earned some trust with me.
At the very least.
And I think even better, he's going to get it. He did such a good job of casting this show. And I think he's going to be able to get anybody he wants to for season 2 after this. People will be lining up.
Certainly think so. There's not a single actor or actress on this show who comes off it with anything but positive shine.
Right. Well, and look, a lot of them are Murphy kind of repertoire regulars. You wouldn't be surprised to see them again, but, in some other form. But I'm sure some great new people come on board too. I think it's going to be a good one. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Something else I think was no perfect again this week was Better Call Saul. And, we talked about it before the show. To me, to have a moment in the episode, we didn't talk last week, but the episode of last week kind of had one of those before credit scenes that was one like you would see in a lot of old Breaking Bad where there's no dialogue really. It was just kind of this funky music and sort of a slice in the life of this guy smuggling drugs across the border. And it's not really referenced again in the episode. You just think it's sort of maybe part of some, slice of life of this vast criminal enterprise. And then all of a sudden you get this reference that pays off directly in the first scene of the next episode. And it's just one of those things that the show does because it's so well thought out and smart, and so few shows, you know, do. They sort of plant these seeds in this way to have it pay off in the next episode in this way where you having that scene the week before brought such a light to this scene where you went, oh, you know, and you knew all the shorthand and it was so well set up. And I just, this show hits notes every week that no show is hitting right now. And I it's so hard for me to imagine someone who was a fan of Breaking Bad not just loving the way that the show has been constructed.
I completely agree, and I will not spoil this, but I think potentially at the end of this week's episode, tell me if you disagree, I feel like we might have just seen the real inciting event behind the Jimmy McGill to Saul Goodman transition.
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible. I mean, we're certainly getting a lot closer to Saul.
Yeah, I think it's such an incredible show. And to your point about the sort of connecting thread from the first scene of one episode to the first scene of the next week, first of all, the only way you ever see, even in the best television today, almost the only way you ever see that one episode to the next true connection is with a cliffhanger. And at the end of the previous episode to, like, the first scene of the next one. And I have to say, those are almost inevitably disappointing.
Yep.
So yeah. the idea that they dropped a kernel and then didn't make you fret about it for a week, but just kind of left it sitting on the table, and then the beginning of the next week when you least expected it, boom, there's the payoff. Like, there's just so much in entertainment that makes you beg for a payoff, and then by the time you get it, it's like, was that really what I was waiting for?
And you'll see Game of Thrones do it, but it's almost, for them, it's a narrative necessity because they're really just, you know, telling, you know, 25 separate stories.
Exactly.
And trying to space them out in a way, and it's really just a linear thing from one part of their story to the next.
And it's not to say that other shows don't have good through lines from episode to episode, because of course plenty of good shows have that, but just the way that Vince Gilligan is just a genius, man, and the way that he connects the threads of narrative, the way that he plays with the characters, and the use of dramatic irony throughout all of Better Call Saul, because we know where these guys end up. It's just, man, he is working on another level. I really believe that. And I actually think Better Call Saul, or rather Breaking Bad, will probably always have a certain level of cachet that Better Call Saul does not. And it probably will end up having had a bigger audience overall because it has a little bit more broad appeal with the, like, just blatant drug dealer story. I think this is a better show.
Wow.
I think it's a better nothing against Breaking Bad, but to me, Better Call Saul reaches a level of just greatness as visual storytelling craft that only really a few shows have ever been for me, and it's like it's a list that includes like The Sopranos and The Wire. You know,
I can't quite go there, but only because to me Breaking Bad is if not the best show of all time, to me it's second or third. Like that's the level of esteem I have for it. But
I'm basically putting it at fifth or sixth, so we're not disagreeing that much. But
I think Saul, you know, you watch the show and you feel like, yeah, it could be part of that conversation at some point.
How about this? In a way, Better Call Saul is a more impressive achievement of that regard because it doesn't have the broadly appealing aspects of Breaking Bad.
And the expectations are, you know, just so much lower going in. You're talking about a show built around, you know, two tertiary characters,
right?
You know, from the first show, and it's, you know, it's every bit the Frasier to its Breaking Bad Cheers with, I think, a chance to be even better. So,
I know people loved loved Frasier. I just like that doesn't comparing something to Frasier doesn't feel like a great compliment to me for whatever reason.
Well, here's what I meant by that, because I didn't love Frasier either, but Frasier is sort of maybe the gold standard of spinoffs. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's one other that's not jumping to mind. Oh, what about one of the Happy Days spinoffs? Mork and Mindy, or
was Mork and Mindy? Yeah, I don't know.
Or
I mean, what do you want to you want to say? Facts of Life and Different Strokes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. There's another one.
Melrose
too.
Place.
But there's another one that we're not thinking of that I heard someone mention earlier today in a different conversation. But yeah, yes, it's. I don't see how there could be a better spinoff. And just while we're in this, I'm going to say again, and I say it every time, I think both of us do every time we bring this up, Rhea Seehorn, who plays Kim Wexler on this show, is such a wonderful actress. And this performance that she's giving in this show is unreal. Yeah. I mean, she has not missed a beat. In the entirety of the two seasons of this show, she has been phenomenal every moment she's on screen. I can't say enough good things about her.
Me too. And she's playing this really complex person.
Yes.
And hits all the notes all the time. You know what I mean?
God, she's so effing good, man.
Yeah. Yeah. You can, half the time you can sort of see the inner monologue right there on her face.
Yes. Yeah. Oh God. The scene yesterday where she's listening to Michael McKean, also one of his best dramatic performances, but she's listening to him sort of try to incriminate Jimmy. That entire scene, just the way she played it, the looks on her face, you feel every bit of her emotion. It is so damn good.
Yeah, and then I'm trying not to spoil this, but her reaction sort of after they've left you know, it's so explosive, and at the time, like, it, you know, you see it, and then you just, you're like, oh, yeah, of course, you know, and it's, she nails it, and yeah. I think the show is just so good, and so consistently good, and I've heard others complain about it, and I frankly don't understand it,
I don't either, and I can't help but think that, like, if you are, for whatever reason, concerned that this show has gotten bogged down in legal process, or in, you know, paperwork, you're missing something. You're horribly, horribly missing something. That's my feeling.
You're looking for the wrong thing. I think,
yeah, maybe.
Okay, let's move. Should we move on to the world of music real quick? Because I did want to hit something that's sort of been the talk of the music business.
First, I want to give you a quick props that I didn't mention this to you beforehand, but I'm way behind because I'm way behind on podcasts in general, but I just got to the Celebration Rock podcast, which, as people may know, is a podcast you produce, the one with the DeLeo brothers of the Stone Temple Pilots.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And, man, it was awesome. Stephen Hyden is awesome as the host of that show, and they have really interesting rock and roll conversations if you're into that sort of thing.
I will accept your props. For those of you who are Grantland fans, Stephen Hyden was the lead music writer there. He's written for Pitchfork and for the AV Club with The Onion, and really great music writer and all around nice guy. And yeah, we talked to you musicians and music critics kind of about pressing rock issues of the day, things through rock history. And it's been a lot of fun. And, you know, you'll hear things like Stone Temple Pilots busting out cell phone recordings of their teenage cover band.
Yes, the early Stone Temple Pilot, the DeLeo brothers cover band playing Rush was
on the Jersey Shore.
Was an incredible highlight. Yeah, no question.
So yeah, lots of great moments, but like that. If you, like me, are a fan of Chuck Klosterman,
yes, he's on the most recent one. That is on my list.
On the most recent one. Yeah, so yeah. Worth checking out. Well, thank you for that, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, one of the favorite subjects of Celebration Rock is Mr. Bruce Springsteen, who made some news this week by canceling a show in North Carolina, you know, due to the I think it's HB2, I mean, whatever,
yeah, whatever
the,
it
you
is.
Know, the transgender bathroom bill that flew through the North Carolina House and has gotten many up in arms. And then Bryan Adams canceled a concert in Mississippi shortly thereafter for the same reason. I feel like that's kind of appropriate. Like, you know, Mississippi is to North Carolina as like Summer of 69 is to Born in the USA, the album. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like it all sort of works out there.
Okay.
It's interesting to me. I mean, obviously, a lot of people have applauded Bruce for this. You know, I suppose some of that depends on what side you are. But to me, the modern protest song is one of these things that, you know, older generations clamor for, right? You know, where are the artists talking about what they mean and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, here's obviously an older artist taking some sort of stand, and it does sort of highlight, can you think of the last time a contemporary artist, you know, was it Kanye or King Katrina? You know what I mean? Like, who's out there? Is it, you know, Kesha suing Dr. Luke? Is that like, you know, the modern version of a contemporary political stand? It does seem to be somewhat absent today. And, you know, I do think there is something of a hunger for it.
First of all, yeah, I mean, I think probably should be pointed out that Bruce Springsteen is not breaking new ground by doing protesty things. He spends 2.5 hours of his 4-hour concert protesting something or other for the last 30 years.
It did sort of shock me that anyone would be surprised by this.
Right. you know, I think, first of all, I mean, I cards on the table, philosophically, I'm right with Bruce Springsteen and Bryan Adams on these things. Screw that backwards ass state and its laws. That being said, plenty of people in North Carolina and probably the vast majority of the people with tickets to the Springsteen concert probably are also against that law, I would imagine. At least a decent percentage. And is it the right protest to cancel a concert people paid for, as opposed to just getting up on stage at that concert and doing your Bruce Springsteen thing and talking about it? I'm not sure.
I think yes. I do think yes. I think he certainly got more visibility by getting up there, by canceling the show, than he would have by making a speech that might not have been on, you know, would have been on YouTube or something like that, you know, some grainy cell phone footage.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think there's something Bruce Springsteen could have done on stage to get nearly as much attention as canceling the show? Because I gotta believe there is.
I don't know, but here's what I'll say, because this does sort of hit home for me, because I went to high school in North Carolina. Uh-huh. I lived in North Carolina for a while. And as you know, I'm from Georgia.
Yep.
Where the House passed a very similar version of this law that the governor wound up vetoing. And he wound up vetoing it for the same reason that, you know, Indiana ultimately kind of rolled back theirs,
right?
Which is corporate pressure. You know, the Atlanta's home to some big corporations, Coca-Cola and Delta.
And there was some of the movies and TV shows shooting right there threatened to pull out as well,
which,
right?
That's a significant deal for Atlanta right now. Yeah. There's a lot of people making movies in Atlanta.
Yep.
Those companies got out. The NFL, you know, hinted that they would be pulling the Super Bowl.
Right.
You know, so everyone got involved, and and cooler heads prevailed. And honestly, you know, modern day, I think that is the most effective tactic. Ultimately, it's money talks. And to me, as a person who falls on the Springsteen side of this issue as well, it's heartening to see, you know, the mainstream of America fighting back and saying we're not going to accept this in a way that's fully consistent with our democracy. I think this act is in that tradition.
Especially while we watch certain people trumpet the opposite of these democratic principles and seem to have success with it. It is encouraging to see capitalist democracy work in that way, because that is capitalism fundamentally.
Right.
As much as it's democracy. That being said, I just, you know, I guess good for him, but maybe I would have done it differently is all I would say about it. But in terms of whether people want protest music in general, is it that, or is it just that everyone wants the celebrities they are a fan of to take the stand that they want?
Well,
you know what I mean?
Because
Steph Curry got some criticism for not outright condemning that law, you know, and matter of fact, I wouldn't say I criticized him, but it made me nervous when I thought for a short period of time that he might not oppose that law. And I never thought it was because he was a bad guy, but he's a very religious guy, and I don't know exactly how that religion is reflected in terms of his views on the LGBT community. So I that worried me because I'm a fan of Steph Curry, and I would have hated to learn that someone I'm a fan of held a view that I found, wrong or you know, reprehensible is strong, but kind of that's what
yeah.
I mean.
Well, but you were a Michael Jordan fan, and he very famously refused to take sides.
That's right, and everyone has the right to refuse to take sides.
Yeah,
and that's not exactly what Steph did, and in fact, he ultimately came out and basically said he was against that law, and that's fine. You can refuse to take sides, but it is going to affect how I think about someone that I'm a fan of, a celebrity that I'm a fan of. If I find out they hold a view, whatever that view, putting this particular issue aside, if I find out that I'm, let's pick a totally random example. I really love the band Radiohead. If I found out that
doesn't feel so random.
No?
No. Oh, I thought because I really love the band Radiohead. I'm like, are you talking about me? So sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say if I found out that Thom Yorke. Thought that the, again, completely random example, I'm trying to be as inoffensive to everybody as possible. If I found out for whatever reason that Thom Yorke was a great supporter of India's caste system, that would upset me a little bit. You know, I want the people I like to hold views that I think are defensible and reasonable, if nothing else, if not outright the same views I hold. And it doesn't mean I hate them or I think they're the worst if they don't share all of my opinions, but when they're views that I think do reflect a certain lack of moral compass, I find that worrisome. And so by the same token, I think when people say things like we need more protest music, it's really just we need somebody famous to speak out on my behalf.
Yeah, you know, I think that's probably true. And this is, you know, something that I have a lot of personal experience with. And maybe, if I could give advice to anyone, I would say, do your best to extricate yourself from wanting to attach your hopes and personalities and or views to musicians or athletes or whatever. I've met a lot of bands. It's just kind of part of my job over the years. And the one thing that I will tell people about media bands, because they ask about this all the time, is that like the work and how you feel about the work that they do has very little to do with how you will feel about them as a person.
Oh, of course.
You will meet bands that you love who become people that you hate, and that's always a bummer.
Yep.
You will meet bands that you hate who become people that you really enjoy.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the opposite is true. There's just nothing that really connects. You know, they're all just a series of strangers. And you're going to find a lot of athletes who don't think that, look, I am a huge Braves fan, and a lot of my Braves heroes do not share my views on a lot of the world.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Baseball players in general are not a particularly forward-thinking bunch.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, okay, I'm going to unfollow you on Twitter, Chipper Jones, and I can keep the Chipper Jones that I remember.
Yeah, which in a way is a shame because he's also super entertaining on Twitter.
Not for me.
Yeah,
not for me.
I guess if you wanted to hold him in some sort of esteem, it would be difficult to do that while following him on Twitter.
Yes, it would be. And it's, you know, so it's like, okay, you know, just maybe it's okay to have a little bit of a curtain that you don't want to peer behind with some of these things. I think you'll find it'll be easier for you in life. Now, that'd be my advice for you. All right, should we do homework?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got a good one this week.
All right.
I this is one. Sometimes, you know, sometimes I'm given these assignments and I just want Kolsky to watch it so we can talk about it.
Yeah.
But this is one I heartily recommend for all of you. It's a show on Amazon. I think it's on Amazon. We are really getting to the point where it's like the Simmons Cousin Sal bit where I'm going to be recommending something from the Shell gas station TV network here pretty soon.
That's right. That's right. You can get this one on your Apple Watch.
Yeah, exactly. but this one is an Amazon exclusive, and it's the show Catastrophe.
Yeah, quickly, only because I did a little background research today, I believe it's actually originally a British show that was on Channel 4 in England that Amazon picked up for U.S. distribution.
Yeah, that might not that would not shock me. It is set over there, and stars an Irish woman and an American comedian by the name of Rob Delaney. It's pretty funny.
Rob Delaney is a very funny guy.
Yeah, with the kind of his own sordid history, and you know, we talked a lot about Love when that show premiered on Netflix, and I feel like this is kind of like a more adult version of that. It's two people who are charming but inherently flawed and a bit acidic, but who have perfect chemistry with each other, you know, meaning in a situation and then just kind of really trying to deal with it as a couple going forward. And it's just as real and honest and hilarious, and it's so watchable. And the seasons are 6 episodes each, and they're, you know, 24 minutes, and it's super duper bingeable and really enjoyable, and I honestly I can't recommend it enough. I really, really enjoyed it, and season 2 is even deeper and richer and kind of beset with the challenges of life than the first one is, and you'll love it, and you can bang it out in the weekend and thank me.
I'm going to attempt to bang it out this weekend. That sounded weird, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, I did season 2 in a day, easy.
Okay, so. Yeah. I mean, well, that's the nice thing about British TV is it's 5-6 episodes at 25 minutes each. It's boom, boom, you're done. So I will try to get at least a significant way into season 1 before we speak again, and then we can talk about it. Quickly, I don't know if this is homework, but just a random question that I probably should have asked you before the podcast. We talked about you sort of falling out of love with The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Have you watched or are you watching Fear the Walking Dead?
It's funny because I was literally thinking about this. I'm so out of love with The Walking Dead. I'm just going, I don't know if I can get it up for Fear.
Huh. Did you watch like, the first season
of
Fear?
I have it on the DVR. And I'm just sort of sitting there like, am I going to start this? Because I just – my enthusiasm has been drained to the point where I just don't – I don't know. I did eventually catch up. So I am caught up with The Walking Dead. I did finish out the season, but it's a slog. And I'm just not excited to revisit that world. So I'm right now I'm leaning towards no.
All right. You did watch the first season of it though?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I did. So, and I thought it was a decent show. It's literally just, I'm just tired. I'm just
don't want to go back
of,
to that world
with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I get so. It. All right. Well, that's one thing we won't talk about then.
All right. yeah. Assign me something else.
yeah, no, I will at some point. I've got nothing for you right now. I'm going to try to get, oh, you know what? Here's one. Are you a House of Lies person?
House of Lies. Is that the Don Cheadle?
Yes.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, I have not yet started it, but the new season debuted this past weekend. And if you watch episode 1 and I watch episode 1 before we next speak, maybe we can throw that in there.
I will watch it tonight.
All right. All right. I feel like we've really accomplished something.
I'm not sure what, but I agree. And on that note, I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Bye.
All right.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.